Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the 42nd President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton.
Good morning. Welcome to the Fourth Clinton Global Initiative. Thank you for taking the time to come here. And thank you for your courage in braving the New York City traffic jam. I want to begin by thanking all of our sponsors, and especially our founding sponsor, Tom Golisano, for making this year's meeting possible. An enormous amount goes into the preparation of this meeting, putting all the panels together, and I'm very grateful for the work of Bob Harrison and our entire staff and all the volunteers have done over the last several months and indeed over the last several years. I would also like to thank particularly our commitment staff, which works with so many of you to put together the commitments and help them to be kept. An enormous number of things have happened since our last meeting. There have been disasters of all kinds. Hurricanes, earthquakes, armed conflict, an explosion in energy prices, which has had a terrifically adverse effect in many developing countries on the price of food and fertilizer and on development plans. And, of course, this deep financial crisis in the United States, which has ramifications across the globe. The question I got asked in doing any number of interviews with the press in the run-up to this meeting is, well, you think half the people will stay home? Will people be worried about this economic crisis? Will people reduce their commitment? Will there be less interest in this? And then, at the same time, if you've read the American press today, you know that our presidential candidates, both of whom will appear here at CGI, they're all being asked, well, how many of your own campaign commitments are you not going to be able to make if we make this pledge of $700 billion to rescue the American financial system? No one knows exactly what is going to happen, how quick the rebound will be, but I will say this. My belief is that the purpose for which we have gathered to enable more private citizens through philanthropy, non-governmental work, to work in partnership with governments to do public good, this purpose is going to be more important than ever in the next few years if there are economic conditions which prevent governments from giving as much as they otherwise would have. And I'm betting on you and people like you throughout the world to say that this crisis is not an excuse to walk away from the world's challenges, but a compelling reason to intensify our efforts to meet them around the corner and around the world. Every one of you has the power to make a difference in these situations, and I am grateful that you're here. Since 2005, when we started CGI, those of you in this room and your predecessors have made 1,000 commitments that are valued at more than $30 billion. and will affect positively the lives of 200 million people in 150 nations. Because of your efforts through CGI commitments, 8 million children now have access to school for the first time or to improved education. Commitments to clean energy have impacted nearly 4 million people, and I hope it will be many, many times that by the time we leave today. More than 11 million now have access to health services or improved health services. More than 3 million increased access to safe drinking water and sanitation. 42 million children have benefited from interventions to address malnutrition or undernutrition, and a large and still unquantifiable number have benefited from the massive commitments to microenterprise made by CGI participants. These are just a few examples that show the power and potential of what we can do together. In the past year, there has been remarkable growth involving more people in commitment making. In March, we held the first meeting of the Clinton Global Initiative University, something launched here last year. The first meeting was at Tulane in New Orleans, appropriately, where more than 600 college students and universities from 16 nations came and made specific commitments to do something on their own campuses or around the world. In December, we'll have the first meeting of CGI outside the United States in Hong Kong. It recognizes the important and growing capacity of leaders and nations in Asia to shape our common future, and will include issues of particular importance of that region. I am honored that Lee Kuan Yew and many other Asian leaders will be participating, as well as a large number of business people that have previously not been involved in this sort of work. Our third expansion has been through the online version of CGA called MyCommitment.org, where people who could never come to this meeting from more than 190 countries and territories have volunteered almost 400,000 hours, pledged about $4 million, and donated 41,000 separate items to charitable causes. I hope the best is yet to come. We will today have discussions and hear from some of the pioneers in poverty alleviation, public health, education, energy, and climate change. We will shine a spotlight on people who've made commitments in years past so we can learn from their experiences, and on several new commitments that people in the room will be making this year. I do want to say I encourage all of you to look around at the exhibits we put out, because we have tried to render an accurate report, particularly of the 240 or so commitments that have been made in past years that have now been completed. So you can see what happens. Most of our commitments are multi-year commitments, but there are 240 which have been made since 2005, which have been honored in their entirety, and you can see the consequences of them, and we try to publicize that in displays in the meeting space. So I hope you'll be able to see that. As you join the discussions and define your own commitments, it is worth a mention of the composition of the attendees. This year, we have nearly 60 heads of state or government, hundreds of top CEOs from major companies, 5 Nobel laureates, leaders of non-governmental organizations from all regions and backgrounds, and committed citizens who want to make a difference. I'd like to start now, without further delay, by doing what we all came here to do. I want to begin by announcing 4 new commitments and ask the people, as I call their names, to join me. The first is one of 2 commitments involving Liberia. As all of you know, I'd like to call President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Maria Itel, the president of the Nike Foundation, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, the managing director of the World Bank, to the stage. Liberia came out of 14 years of civil conflict with a per capita income of under a dollar a day, well under a dollar a day. In just 2 years, the President Johnson Sirleaf has produced an explosion of progress. Her per capita income when I was just there is up to $400 a year. And to give you an idea of what can be done under proper governance, 4 years after the Rwandan genocide, their per capita income was still under $300 a year. 10 years later, it's $1,000. It's almost quadrupled in a decade. I predict to you that her results will outstrip that. Not only that, something that I invited her yesterday morning, and she'll talk about what she did yesterday, to become America's budget advisor. She's managed to do all that and balance her budget besides. So I think we should see. But they still have very serious challenges in reducing poverty and increasing the capacity of energy and promoting growth and dealing with a lot of the challenges. So the Nike Foundation, the government of Liberia, and the World Bank have made a commitment to improve economic opportunities for adolescent girls in post-conflict Liberia, linking skills training to labor. With $5 million over 3 years, the initial pilot project is designed to smooth the path to employment for 1,500 adolescent girls and young women. The girl effect, as it has been called, is the powerful social and economic change brought about when girls have an opportunity to fully participate in their society. Well, besides, I'd say this like a broken record, but I would say it. If you think about climate change, the scientists say we have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 80% by 2050 to avoid the worst impacts. During the same period, the world's population is projected to grow from 6.5 to 9 billion. It would be difficult to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% if population stayed constant. The whole question of population is fraught with moral, religious, cultural, and political debate. The only thing that has been done that seems to find warm embrace across all religious faiths and all regions of the world that slows population growth is to put every single girl in the world in school and give every young woman adequate, equal access to the labor markets of the world. And so I want to say that this is important for what happens in Liberia, but it's the sort of thing we need to be doing everywhere. So let's give them a big hand. Thank you. Now, the second commitment involves other foundations. I'd like to ask Pam Omidyar, the founder of Humanity United, and Peter Buffett, the co-chair of Novo Foundation, to come up. They, the Daphne Foundation, the Global Philanthropy Forum, the McCall-McBain Foundation, Trust Africa, are working with the government of Liberia to establish a new model for donor-investor-government partnership, and they have committed $15 million to collaborate with the president to bring a group of foundations together to comprehensively coordinate their efforts to support Liberia's reconstruction and development, focusing on private sector development, health and education, energy and climate change, and governance. And this is a big deal. There are a lot of us who are working in countries where we work in the same countries, and we don't talk to each other, we don't coordinate our money, our work, and the money is not spent as effectively as possible. I think the potential of this common effort to leverage the impact of all these NGOs by harmonizing their efforts is enormous, and in our opening plenary, the President will talk more about this. But if you just think about those of you that are active in several countries, how many you sit here and you talk to people and you meet every year, and yet when you go back to the countries, you may or may not ever work with them, and you may be actually undermining the impact that your investments of time and skills and money could have by not harmonizing and coordinating this. So this is a big potential effort for that we perhaps all should participate in. So let's give them a big hand here. Thank you. No, well, you have to come back. You have to come back. You're not off the hook yet. The third commitment involves Areva and Duke Energy. So I'd like to ask Anne LeVergeon, the Chief Executive Officer of Areva, and Jim Rogers, the Chairman and President and CEO of Duke Energy, to come up. This is a commitment. This is a commitment to avoid approximately 4 million tons of CO2 emissions per year by 2014. Two global energy leaders coming together to announce a new renewable energy business with a commitment to carbon neutral solutions and the creation of new green-collar jobs in the United States. The Duke Areva Partnership plans to design, build, and operate 10 to 12 standardized wood biomass power plants in the U.S. by 2014, bringing to commercial scale this underutilized source of renewable electricity. One 50-megawatt wood biomass plant will avoid net emissions of 400,000 tons of CO2 per year and generate enough electricity for 40,000 households. Wood biomass currently produces about 6,000 megawatts of electricity in the U.S., but estimates indicate we can double that between now and 2019. And I can think of several places with shut-down timber mills who will be happy to hear this announcement. Thank you very much. Now I would like to ask Lance Armstrong, the founder and chairman of the Lance Armstrong Foundation, and Mayor Bloomberg, our host mayor, to come up. This commitment is to broaden the scope and reach of the Armstrong Foundation from a national to an international effort to support cancer survivors and make cancer an international priority. It's an $8 million commitment over 5 years to launch an international awareness campaign and create grassroots movements in countries across the globe, to convene the Live Strong Global Cancer Summit in Paris at the end of Lance's comeback race in the 2009 Tour de France, where world leaders will commit to making cancer a priority in their countries. It is the second leading cause of death in the world, claiming 8 million lives per year. And experts predict that cancer rates could increase by 50% to 15 million new cases a year by 2020. But a third of them could be cured if detected early and treated properly. This is an exceptional commitment by an exceptional person, and so I would like to invite Lance Armstrong to make a few remarks, and then he will introduce the mayor. But let's take a picture. Let's give him a hand.
Well, it is truly an honor to be on this stage, in this room, with this company. Mr. President, you've been a longtime friend of mine. I will never forget visiting the White House after my first Tour de France victory in 1999, and we were told that we had 7 minutes with the president. The president's busy, so we walked out. I gave the president a bike. I gave him a helmet. And we were in the Rose Garden, and I stopped, and I said, wow, look at that magnolia tree over there. That seven-minute visit turned into a 47-minute visit because of the magnolia tree. I happen to be a real fan of magnolia trees, and I come to find out that so is the president. So thank you. Thank you for being a friend and for allowing us to be here to talk about this critical issue. Mayor Bloomberg, thank you for having us in your city. As always, we love it here. As the president said, this disease takes 8 million people around the world every year, 22,000 people a day. If you look at it, just looking at the stats, that is more than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. This must be a global health priority. It is the reason that we are here today. There is much we can do. There's a man just up the street from here in Harlem by the name of Dr. Harold Freeman. And Dr. Freeman taught me a very important thing a couple of years ago just by running the Cancer Center in Harlem. As he walked the halls and he looked at the underserved and the uninsured and underinsured populations, he said, Lance, you see these people, he says, we have the information and the technology and the medicine to save their lives, but we do not apply it in the United States of America. And as long as we do that, that's a moral and an ethical failure. The same goes true for Africa. The same goes true for South America. We have the medicine. We have the procedures. We have the technology to save lives in all of these continents. Africa, for example. While we're there working on so many other critical and important issues that will change the lives and change the face of a generation forever, the number one killer of young women in the continent of Africa is cervical cancer. With the HPV vaccine, we could save nearly 100% of these young ladies' lives. And so us as Americans, or us as in an international community, if we are not doing that, if we are not applying the medicine that we have to the people that need it the most, then we are failing morally and ethically. That must change, and that is the reason for the Live Strong Global Awareness Campaign that we will launch beginning today. As some of you may or may not know, I've decided to race my bicycle again. It's not very often that somebody gets a chance to spend 3 or 4 years away from something, step back, and then say to themselves, I sort of miss that. I'd like to go back and do that again. But I've had that opportunity, and with this campaign, we feel that by racing the bicycle all over the world, beginning in Australia, ending in France, at the Global Summit, it is the best way to promote this initiative. It's the best way to get the word out. I was just backstage speaking with my good friend Bono. There's no difference. When Bono goes to play a concert in Buenos Aires, he talks about his issue. When he plays a concert in New York City, he talks about critical issues. This is a campaign. This is a campaign to spread the word, create awareness, and ultimately, and hopefully, save lives. Partnerships here are critical. We know that we cannot do this alone. We know that the President Clinton's Foundation cannot do this alone. We have to partner with other NGOs, like we've done here in the United States. We have to partner with corporations. We've been longtime partners with Nike, for example, who created the Live Strong Collection that donates 100% of the proceeds to this fight, 100%. They do not make a dime off the sale of those goods in order to fight cancer. We also have to work with governments. I know Mary Robinson's here. I got to meet Mary earlier. She governed a smoke-free Ireland. We know that that works. She was instrumental in signing the World Cancer Declaration and making sure that it's a constant reminder out there. So I look forward to 2009. I look forward to racing again. I cannot guarantee an 8th tour victory, but I can guarantee you that the Live Strong message will touch all aspects of our society, all continents of our society, and certainly touch on all the different diseases and facets of cancer that need the attention. So thank you. And finally, it's my honor to introduce another good friend of mine, the mayor of this great city, Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Thank you. Lance, thank you. I was thinking the mistake I made when I went to visit the president in the Rose Garden was not going during the season the magnolias were in bloom. I don't remember whether I got 7 minutes or 6 minutes or just a handshake, but I guarantee you it wasn't as long as you did. And I did like your comments about coming back and doing it again, but that's a whole nother issue. Anyways, thank you, and Mr. President, thank you for hosting us. We're honored every time we're invited. You know, when Michael Phelps won 8 gold medals this summer, it revived the old debate about who was the greatest athlete of all time. And Lance Armstrong earned his place in this discussion when he overcame cancer to win the Tour de France for a record 7 straight times. I don't think there's any doubt that he is a great athlete, but being the greatest really means excelling on and off the field. And Lance's story simply transcends the sport of cycling. Lance is now writing a new chapter in his book, and he's coming out of retirement, setting his sights on Paris once again. But this time, it's not to win, it's to beat. And it's beating cancer that is the real objective here. I wonder if Lance will remember what it takes to win. I say he won't forget. It's just like riding a bike. That's all you got to do. I mean, you get on, you pedal. What's so complicated about all of this? You may know I have a passion for public health, and I can tell you that one of the greatest challenges is capturing people's attention in new ways and engaging them in problems while they have been around for a while. And looking through the audience, I saw people like Eli Broad, who are my role models, people who really made a lot of money and then went out and made a difference. And they work every day seriously to try to address those problems that this world sadly still has. Fighting cancer is one of them, fighting smoking, which causes more deaths, as Lance pointed out, than most other diseases added together. That's been one of my great focuses, and it's one of the focuses of New York City. With his latest comeback, Lance really has come up with an innovative way to galvanize awareness about cancer. Millions will be turning into the tour, making it a golden opportunity to bring new energy to the fight against one of mankind's most ruthless killers. And as someone who shares Lance's commitment to public health, I'm intent on making sure that this opportunity is not wasted. Between now and July, my foundation will work with Lance and Livestrong to ensure that when people watch the tour, they're considered cancer prevention. This really is a unique opportunity to make people aware of what they can do and how they can get involved. And part of our partnership will center on the anti-tobacco initiatives that my own foundation has launched around the world. Few people know it, but about 1 out of every 5 cancer deaths is from smoking, and they are all preventable. As Lance told Vanity Fair, and sometimes people say things that you remember for the rest of your life, and this I certainly will, he said, it's the only product you can buy, and if you follow the instructions, it will kill you. Just think about that. We know how to reduce tobacco use, but what we need is the political and community leadership to get it done. Only 5% of the world's population is covered by any of the most effective strategies like taxes on tobacco and smoking bans and hard-hitting commercials that explain what smoking really is doing to your body. And that's why my foundation's committed $375 million to empower and encourage governments to take action and make their country smoke-free. And I was thrilled when we were able to enlist the help of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has contributed another $125 million to this effort. The Gateses are just wonderful. We all face a similar challenge in the fight against cancer. We know a lot about what it takes to prevent disease, but there is a huge gap between what we know and what we are actually doing. Too many countries for too long have not taken advantage of prevention methods that work, like better nutrition, vaccines, cancer screening. There are lots of ways to work on cancer. None of these problems are easy. They all require self-sacrifice. They all require government leadership. Sometimes these things just aren't politically popular. I can tell you my first year in office, when I raised taxes, closed firehouses, and put a smoking ban in, I was not the most popular person in New York City. As a matter of fact, if you could do a parade on Staten Island after that, you're prepared for the rest of your life. But today, Nobody smokes in this city, or very few people smoke. We've been able to reduce teenage smoking by better than 50% in this city. And that's going to lead for decades to fewer people coming down with heart attacks and getting cancer and a lot of other things. Lance is our hero for the day and for the week and for the month and for the year and maybe for all times. He is one of those people, and there are plenty of others. You mentioned Bono, for example. I think the president can be added to that list. People who are trying to make a difference. They don't just talk about the problems. They're trying to do something about it, and they deserve our admiration, and they deserve our support, and I'm just thrilled to be a little part of it. So thank you, and we've got to keep up the fight.
I just want to say very briefly something about both these people. Mr. Mayor, first of all, you may not have spent 47 minutes at the White House, but if we don't get this financial situation straightened out, my guess is you can spend all the time you want there, no matter what happens in this election, because I consider the mayor not only to be one of the finest mayors New York City ever had, and that's really saying something. We've had some good ones, but one of the ablest public servants I have ever known. It's easy for us to forget about this now. But when he put that smoking ban in New York, in our restaurants and night establishments, it was in the middle of what we thought was going to be a prolonged recession, and he was told that this was going to reduce revenues in one of the few income-producing sectors of our economy at the time by 15 or 20%. And he basically said it's the right thing to do, and if it saves a few lives, it's worth the money. And in the end, he wound up being more popular, and he richly deserves it. I admire him. I'm grateful for his service, and my guess is there's a lot more ahead. Let me just say one thing about Lance Armstrong. We have been friends a long time, but I want to say something that he just sort of alluded to at the end. The world has its fair share of genuine victims. The victims of the genocide, of, you know, the children pressed into conflict, the horrible things that have happened to the people in Darfur, the people who have been hit in Haiti and elsewhere by the recent natural disasters. But it's better if the smallest number of them possible think of themselves as victims, and instead think about what they can do to change their own circumstances, to seize control of their own destiny, to build a different future. The thing I always admired about Lance Armstrong when he dealt with his own cancer and then he started organizing these efforts around the world and started selling these little bracelets, and there are well over 50 million of them in distribution around the world, is that the whole message is do not think of yourself as a victim. And an enormous amount of what we're here to do is to empower people to change their circumstances. He's a walking advertisement that it works. Thank you very much. Thank you. Now, I want to bring the panelists out again. First, Her Majesty Queen Rania Al Abdullah, the Queen of Jordan, an outspoken advocate of non-governmental organization activity in the Middle East and across the world, a promoter of education. She recently launched a comprehensive plan called Madrasati to better the learning environment of Jordanian schools. She has been a real force for cross-cultural dialogue, most recently launching a YouTube channel to dispel stereotypes about Arabs and Muslims. She's active in the World Economic Forum, the United Nations Foundation, the Gavi Fund, and UNICEF's first eminent advocate for children. Second, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf from Liberia, whom you've already met, educated at both the United States and Liberia, former finance minister, human rights advocate, member of the international banking community. She has paid a price for her belief in democracy and freedom, and she was rewarded by her stunning election to the presidency a couple of years ago and her promise to promote economic development and end corruption and civil war. Neville Isdell is the chairman of the board of directors of the Coca-Cola Company, for whom he has worked for more than 40 years. Born in Northern Ireland, raised in Africa, a true citizen of the world who has promoted Coca-Cola in 11 countries. He retired in 2000 and was called out of retirement to serve as chairman and CEO of the Coca-Cola Company. He has been a leader in the global business community with the UN Global Compact, USAID, the CEO Water Mandate. He is the chairman of the U.S.-Russia Business Council, the International Business Leaders Forum, and he's still working on the problems of global water and trying to make General Motors into an electric car company. Bono is perhaps the best-known rock star in the world for something besides his music, although most of us of a certain age love that. In 2002, he co-founded DATA, Debt, AIDS, Trade, and Africa, to raise public awareness of the issues in its name. He has been, for as long as I have known him, an intense advocate for doing more about AIDS and debt relief. He co-founded Product Red, which partners with iconic global brands to deliver corporate profits to buy AIDS drugs for people in Africa. And he has launched EDUN, or EDUN, an ethnically sourced fashion company to produce clothing in developing areas of the world. And finally, a man I am mildly acquainted with, Al Gore, the most recent recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. And a man who has literally given his life to protect the climate for future generations, and who now, among other things, is head of Alliance, is running some of the best television ads I have ever seen. And I don't know if you've seen any of their advertisements trying to raise awareness not just to the problem of climate change, but of the solutions and what we should demand. Last one of Al's ads I saw, I thought if our ads had been that good, we'd have gotten 15 or 20 million more votes when we were running. So this is a great group, and we're going to have a good discussion. Let's welcome them all here. Thank you.
I would like to start, if I might, with Queen Rania and ask her to talk a little bit about what she's trying to do with education in Jordan. We've already had the discussion of what it means to all developing countries to have access of girls to all levels of education and ultimately to the labor market. What are you trying to do with your project? And what can non-governmental groups do to help?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to begin by talking about education in general. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about the world's ills, whether it's conflict and crises, hunger, disease, clash of civilizations. And the one tool that we have that's most effective at dealing with all these issues, that cuts through all of them, is education. So in my mind, education is the best immunization that we can give Mother Earth for the world's ills and take care of a lot of these issues. And when you think about it, it's a shot that we can afford. It takes $11 billion a year to educate every child. $11 billion is about 10% of NATO's military budget for last year. And by the way, it's about what Europe pays for ice cream every year. So if you think about it, if we spend $11 billion less on defense and military expenses and more on education, imagine the kind of peace, security, and not to mention prosperity that you can buy. In Jordan, Jordan is a resource-poor country, and we've managed to achieve very high access rates in terms of coverage of education. So we wanted to move away from expanding education to reforming education. And as I said, we are a resource-poor country, and as a result, a lot of our schools were, the buildings were old and tired and run down. And it might seem kind of obvious what the government should do, just fix them. But our government was struggling with priorities. Do you put technology in classrooms with broken windows? How do you teach children creativity in drab buildings with cracked walls? How do you encourage them to think independently when the schools are classes are overcrowded? So we had to really stop and rethink the whole equation and shift gears. So what we did was we did an assessment of the 500 most rundown public schools in Jordan. And then we invited the private sector to come and adopt these schools. And it wasn't very easy. At the very beginning, a lot of people in the private sector said, hey, that's not our job. That's the government's job. And the government, they were saying, stay away. That's our job. 5 months into it, everybody realizes that it's everyone's job. And I think that that's the most important achievement, is the fact that we changed. There was a paradigm shift in the mentality where education is no longer just the responsibility of the government. It's everyone's responsibility. It's a national responsibility, a social responsibility that cuts through sectors. And, so far we've fixed 100 schools. We have 400 more to go. We have three ministry departments, government departments involved. We have 45 companies from the private sector, 15 NGOs working on this project, and we're still in phase one. And most importantly is that it's changed the relationship between the private sector and the government. It was all too easy for the private sector to always blame the ministries for anything that goes wrong. But now that they're involved in the process, they're more sympathetic with the kind of responsibility and the burden that the government faces. And likewise, the ministries are now looking, they used to be suspicious of the private sector, and now there's more trust between them. So it's really been a very enlightening experience, and the fact that everybody in Jordan now feels that they have a stake in education and they have a sense of ownership of the whole process has been, I think, one of the greatest achievements.
Thank you.
Let me say that, for whatever it's worth, that's also something that we need in the United States. One of the most encouraging things to happen in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina is the growth of what we call charter schools, schools that are part of the public school movement but started by private citizens. And about half the New Orleans public schools now that have been reopened are charter schools. And it's changed the whole culture of the community. They're from a sense of hopelessness in education to a sense of empowerment. And not that miracles have been performed, but that progress has been made. And I think it's really interesting, because the statement you just made would still seem strange to most ears in most parts of the world.
Absolutely.
There's still, in rich and poor countries and countries in between, most places you don't have this level of private involvement.
Absolutely. And it took a lot of push and shove to get people involved and get them to agree on an agenda and to get the private sector companies to look for their motivation to be beyond just PR. But, what I've learned is that, you're not going to achieve the MDGs by playing it safe. Sometimes you have to take risk. You have to have your business model in place, but you have to take risk. And, I've learned that from, Muhammad Yunus when he decided to establish a bank for the poor. I learned it from Bono, who, didn't play it safe when he decided how he was going to approach Africa. So that entrepreneurial spirit of risk really needs to be applied and developed for us to really make a difference.
Let's just go down the way here. First, Madam President, we've already set this up, but you can talk about whatever you want. But I would like to point out that yesterday morning we met, she and I did, with about, 30 or 40 other NGO representatives in a meeting hosted by George Soros to talk about this whole question of how all the people that are now falling all over themselves wanting to help Liberia could maximize their impact. And so why don't you talk a little about that? Let me say, when I first went there to announce my foundation's involvement in AIDS, it's very interesting in view of what Queen Rania just said. I said, well, what else do you want me to do? She said, I want you to meet with my college students. At the time, Monrovia, at night, fewer than 20% of the lights were back on. Electricity hadn't even been restored. These kids were dressed up. I don't know how they were even prepared, and they were as impressive as any young people I have ever met. This time, she asked me to get her some private investment. Bob Johnson put together $30 million in CGI commitment from African-American business people since Liberia was founded by former American slaves. They built a hotel, and then she got him to build another one. So she's a genius at getting people to do about 50% more than they thought they were getting into. And so now she's trying to organize us all so we don't fall all over each other. And perhaps you could at least talk about that. I think that is a problem, a general challenge that we face in the entire developed world. So won't you tell us what you think we ought to do about that?
Thank you, Bill. Let me start off by saying that in Liberia, we're involved in one of the most challenging, most risky, most potentially resulting transformation. Moving a failed state, a collapsed economy, back to the path of growth. We've done that. We grew at 9.5% last year. Restoring our international credit worthiness. We've gone a long way, tackling our $4.7 billion external debt. Restoring basic services like education, health. We've had great partnerships in all of this. We've had good bilateral partners, multilateral partners. And then we've gone beyond that. How do we, you know, get our economy functioning again? And, you know, we're not a poor country. We've got good resources, natural resources. So how do we put that to work? Our mineral resources, our forestry resources, agricultural resources, marine resources. And that means attracting private capital and private investment. But to do that, you also have to do these other things, like you mentioned, you know, get the roads built and the electricity and the water back. And so that brings the bilateral partners into play. And we've had a lot of success on that. In fact, we spent the first 2 years just trying to get our financial house in order, trying to restore the reputation of the country, trying to mobilize the resources through partnerships. We did find that, as you said, so many institutions of goodwill have been wanting to do things, and you've got the foundation, because we saw that as a very important area of support. We don't expect that official flows will continue. The trend has been declining. And so we know we've got to branch beyond that and mobilize those resources. And many of them have come, have been doing a lot of things. And one of the things we said was we've got to get them together. We've got to get it harmonized and properly coordinated so you don't have people going off and doing things that may be very small. If we want to scale up the activities, if we want to really get more bang for the bucks, then you got to bring them together, determine what are the really key priorities, and then bring everybody against that. And that was the meeting that we had. And Humanity United, we just made a commitment to support this effort of bringing them all together against a few priorities. Scaling up the activities is something that you think will help us. And that meeting just brought together a lot of good people around the room, and they all agreed, yes, we should not all be going off in our different directions doing our own things. We should all come together. And then we'll make this an annual event in which we'll come back and we'll track the progress on what we agreed on as a priority, what we achieved, what's the progress, what new interventions can we do to be able to consolidate the gains that have been made. So we're really looking forward to that. And there's the NGO, as you mentioned, we're going to have another meeting with them on Friday, the interaction group, where we're bringing the NGOs together who get a lot of their support from bilateral partners. But again, they do a lot of things that may not conform to our development agenda, which is very clear in our poverty reduction strategy. I want to make sure everybody stays on that same path. So that we'll be able to do. And I tell you, the commitment made by Novo Foundation and the World Bank is another very innovative thing that Maria Ethel and I have been talking about, and that's solving one of our big challenges, which is unemployment. Thousands and thousands of young people, many of them war-affected youth, who have no skills, that are just there on the streets. How do we train them? How do we get them into jobs? And we've started that, but you find most times the girls have been left behind because they haven't had the benefit of education. When families are poor, they put priorities on the boys who will become the breadwinners. And so this particular program is meant to not only to provide training for some of the young girls between the ages of 16 and 24, but the target is about 1,500 of them that will be trained for specific jobs in the private sector, where we'll identify the mines that are opening up and the agriculture concessions. We'll be able to say to them, you know, what kind of skills do you need? And then this program will train those girls specifically for that, so when they've been trained, they go straight into a job. And that to us is different, it's innovative, and the commitment that was made today should enable us to get that program started. And the results, we think, are just going to be so tremendous, because not only will these girls be trained and have a job, but it's going to make a big difference on the whole attitude toward the training of girls and the education of girls, which is one of the things that we've also put priority on when we enforce primary compulsory education. We found that it benefited most of the girls because they were the ones who were not going to school. And so, you know, for us, like I say, it's a big transformative initiative of trying to do things differently, trying to maximize the kind of support that we've enjoyed from everybody. The commitment made a year ago by Bob Johnson, and to be able to provide this facility that would train Liberian entrepreneurs is well underway. And we've got him to go beyond that to start to do a hotel, and that's well underway. And that's going to help to find accommodation for my good friend here, President Halonen, who's in the room from Finland. She and I are going to chair a colloquial next March in Monrovia on women empowerment, when we hope we'll bring all the women leaders to come in and look at the progress and determine how we can support much more women empowerment. So,
let me ask you, just for the benefit of the people here, tell them the population of Liberia. What's the current population?
3.4 million.
3.4 million. And here's the point I want to make to all of you. This is to the donor community. I think that we're all struggling to get models that work. And my view is, once you get something that works, you get other people to support it in other places. We have the leader of East Timor here. He has about 300,000 people, maybe a little more now. And we're glad to see you looking so healthy and recovered from your wounds. I believe that we should look at doing intense projects in limited population areas with the view of producing big results. And even if you go to a big country, you know, President Obasanjo, the former president of Nigeria, is here. It's the most populous country in Africa. We have a big project in Ethiopia, but we found that our only ability to model it and get people to believe that we should do something nationwide is to break it down into discrete population groups, so we can say we did these things. Even if you just did it in one place, then you got a provable model. But I think the smaller countries, for those of you who, particularly if you have relatively limited resources and nobody's as big as the Gates Foundation, this is something you ought to look at, how we can have a measurable result that can then be modeled in bigger places. And it's very, very important. I predict to you that you will see a breathtaking increase in all the positive social indicators in Liberia under her leadership, especially if the rest of us help. Thank you very much. Neville. I want to ask you a couple of questions, but let's begin with the big one here that will be on everybody's mind. Given all this economic upheaval, what do you think is going to happen to global companies like Coke in terms of their involvement in the kinds of things we discuss here? You think there'll be, if the stock price drops on the New York Stock Exchange, is there going to be enormous pressure from the board or from the stockholders or inside the heads of business executives to retrench, or should you be doing more? How should the kinds of things you are involved in, clean water, the whole range of issues, be viewed in terms of a company's mission, and how should it be affected by changes in the stock prices and general economic adversity?
Well, you know, the stock price is something that, in a way, looks after itself if you look after running your business the right way. And that is the way that the board that I head and also the company has looked at it over the years. Now, let me go back to where we are today, because you know, no one has a crystal ball at the moment. We are sitting here today in New York with the greatest financial crisis that we've seen since 1929, 1931. And there still is a danger that it could go in that direction unless the sort of actions that are being taken over the weekend and the last few weeks in terms of restoring liquidity, but more importantly, restoring trust into the market, unless those actions are taken quickly. Because our whole system is under threat, and I'm linking this to your question, because unless the leaders very quickly ensure that that trust is rebuilt, it is always the cash flow that causes recessions. It is always that drives companies out of business. And we've seen that trust break down, and I think looking for the causes, something we should do later, we've got to solve it now. I believe that will be done. And then what we have to do with our own businesses is look at it as an opportunity, because it is an opportunity. And I think we're at a time where we're better off, providing the liquidity crisis is resolved, we're better off as global businesses today than we were in 1998. Because the developing world has actually got a very solid basis today in general. We're not looking at bad fiscal policies. We're looking at good foreign exchange reserves. I think what we're seeing is the epicenter of the world economy is starting to move, and it's moving in different directions, moving out of the West. That's where the growth is. So if you sit where we are, we will continue to invest in those emerging markets. And if you take Africa, Africa is 7% of our overall global business. That's high for most global companies. But it's 10% of our growth. I believe you're going to see in the future it's 12%, 13%. But only if, and we'll do this, we continue to make the investments that we're making, and only if we work together with business and civil society to do what you're trying to do what everyone on this panel I know believes in, and that is get the real multiplier effect that we get from businesses and civil society and governments working together. That's the way that we mobilize. And in my view, the old model of the 20th century of a business, whereby Milton Friedman said that the only purpose of a business is to make a profit, is last century. It is not 21st century. And if our economic model is going to hold up, if we're going to have the global social license to continue with free markets, continue with successful sustainable globalization, we're going to have to work within that model. And that means that we also have to be a functioning part of every community and every society in which we operate. We have to do that in a way that is legitimate to our business, because our share owners are going to ask us that question. But, you know, I think the part of the problem is that we've lived in hermetically sealed view of our business, and as if our own employees don't live in the civil society. They do. And as we've got involved more and more in these projects, like water and education, HIV/AIDS in Africa, our own people are more motivated, and we're actually employing better people. There's a virtuous circle here. And the opportunity is in dangerous times. So the successful business in 5 to 10 years' time is going to be the one that looks at this crisis and says, there is an opportunity, and continues to invest in emerging markets.
First of all, thank you, and thanks for the plug for Africa, which only gets headlines in the West when something bad happens, and there's way more good than bad happening there now. So, but I want to ask you a very specific question about a specific issue. Let me begin by telling all of you, in the work that I do a lot of in this HIV/AIDS work around the world, no company has been a better partner than Coca-Cola, because they've gone every place that they work where there's a substantial HIV/AIDS issue. They stick their necks out and they tell their employees, we want you to be tested. We want to know if you're HIV positive. You will not be fired. You will not be punished. We want you to live. We want your family to be safe. It's a really impressive thing. They have helped us enormously to remove the stigma from this issue as a company, and they deserve an enormous amount of credit for that. Now, you also got to have a lot of water to produce Coke all over the world. And water is a commodity in severe distress. As you know, already virtually 1 billion people have no access to clean water. You've worked on this a lot. Do you believe, given the problems of climate change and all the things that impinge on water, do you believe with presently available technologies, there are affordable solutions to solve the water crisis that exists instead of letting it get worse with more growth of population and economic activity? And if so, what are the most important things people like us can be doing about that?
Well, I mean, water is a huge issue, and it's the one that has not had the spotlight on it, which should have the spotlight on it, because it has caused wars and it can cause wars again in the future. Our starting point is our own footprint, because it's integral to what we do. And I think that's what everyone should be doing. And we have declared that we are going to be water neutral, including the product that we have, by all of the activities that we do around the world. One piece of that, and we will achieve this by 2010, is that in the almost 1,000 factories around the world, all of the wastewater that we put out is going to go back into nature in a form which can support aquatic life. And, yeah, that costs money. But at the end of the day, what we're finding with each one of these initiatives, and this is the message to other businesses, is that you save money. You save money through the efficiency in the aggregate. So that's one side of it. That is the preservation. Now, there are areas where there's going to be real difficulty, water-stressed areas, where populations are growing and where there is not the availability of the water. And that is probably the biggest single issue that we don't have an answer to, because there may have to be population movements. If you leave those ones aside, I believe that there are enough solutions to be able to make water available. One of the programs we have at WWF, we're working on seven water basins, to clean up the rivers. There is enough availability, not availability of clean water. And again, if I talk about sustainable communities, if you're working in the developing world, you need to be sure that you are investing in those people, with these people, in terms of making water available. I was at a plant of ours in India the other day. We had just provided wells to the towns around, to stop the woman having to walk 5 kilometers to the river to pick up water. That's the engagement that we have to have in the new paradigm for the 21st century. But it is going to take this triangle of sustainability, government, civil society, and businesses to make it happen, no question. And then on the technological front, I think certainly for some of the stressed areas on coasts, desalinization, I think the technology is going to move there, and you see Dow Chemical, for example, making a major, major investment in that with new technologies. But I am not so optimistic as to say that in some of the really stressed areas we have the solutions yet. But in the aggregate, yes, I believe we can find them.
So, Bono, you are here primarily to worry politicians in America and coming to the UN meeting. Why are we behind in meeting the Millennium Development Goals? And are you worried that the current economic crisis is going to provide a convenient but not persuasive excuse to do less? And what can all of us do to help get us back on track?
Who was it who said there's no second act in American life? Here's two Americans who are changing the world in and out of office. You're two extraordinary men. And I just want to say that. You know, I'm not qualified to comment on really what's happened in the last week where this city has changed shape, certainly psychologically, and in terms of some people's wallets. And I'm not qualified to comment on the interventions that have been put forth. I presume these people know what they're doing. But it is extraordinary to me that you can find $700 billion to save Wall Street, and the entire G8 can't find $25 billion to save 25,000 children who die every day of preventable, treatable disease and hunger. That's mad. That is mad. Bankruptcy is a serious business, and we all know people who've lost their jobs in the last week. I do, anyway. It's a serious business. But this is moral bankruptcy. And this country that we sit in is a great country. And it's a great country because it's not just a country, it's an idea. And that idea was supposed to be contagious. And it's bound up in the idea of the inalienable rights of men and women and children to equal in the eyes of God. And I think the failure of the Millennium Development Goals tell us that we don't really believe that anymore. And there's an attempt to resuscitate them this week. Certainly, our polling, because we've done a lot of research on what people feel about aid. I think Americans are generous. I think Europeans the same if they feel that there's effective use of aid. That's what our research is telling us. And so, you know, we've seen what debt cancellation has done. You've been talking about on education. And I badgered these two men when they were in office about debt cancellation, and they led the way with the United States. We started the debt campaign in London with this great man, Muhammad Ali, sitting there. And I'd like to salute him. And all the fanfare and all the dumb parade and all the marching, what did it achieve? Well, it actually achieved an incredible amount. Because of African leadership, kind of Ellen Johnson's surleaf here, there's now 29 million children going to school over the last 5 years in Africa alone. An extra 29 million children. We wish there were more school books. We wish there was more teachers. We wish there were better classrooms. But But that's an extraordinary thing and shows what can happen. AIDS, when you left office, people laughed at us when we said that a conservative, a religiously conservative administration would ever take on the AIDS emergency. Well, they did. And I credit George Bush, because now there's nearly 3 million people on antiretroviral drugs in the last few years, over 2 million in Africa. And that just shows you what can happen if people across both sides of the party work together. Because as you know, it took both sides of Congress to get that. So I think the most important thing is to get through this impasse, is to show success. You know, 49 million malaria bed nets distributed. Malaria in, I think, Ethiopia and Rwanda halved. Real in Kenya, in Zambia, a third taken out. I mean, there's great progress. This week we'll see an amazing announcement. No malaria, no more malaria deaths by 2015. And that will be history this week in New York City if that happens. And I think we need to, energy moving forward, to answer your question. That's exciting. People want to get on that bus. They want to get on that train. And in this election, what we've been doing with the One campaign is to try and make all the candidates aware that in the United States, I'm just talking about the United States because we're here in the United States, people want to show the world the best of America, innovation, technology, pharmacology. This is the best of America. And I think it was Warren Buffett said to me years ago at an AIDS speech, he said, don't appeal to the conscience of America. He said, appeal to the greatness of America. And I think you got the job done. So we're here.
Well, let me just say, give him a hand. I believe that we can keep our part going if you can remind people about what the numbers are. The president of Iraq is here, Mr. Talabani. They've reached an agreement with the United States that we should end our involvement there by 2011 if the election, because of other factors, something's going to happen in that regard. Queen Rania said we're $11 billion short in education. That's just a little more than 1 month of the Iraq War. Just a little more than a month. Just one thing. I think that one thing that you can do that's really important is to emphasize the results that have been achieved from the AIDS and tuberculosis and malaria efforts and from the debt relief efforts, the education. Most people don't know that. Most people don't know we did it. They don't know what we did when we were in office. They don't know what President Bush has done and the Congress. And they don't know what the results are. So I think that's important. People know they get it. There is a big understanding in America that there's a limit to how much you can get out of military power and that we need more friends and fewer adversaries. There is an enormous understanding, but they need to know what this has produced. I also want to say that Bono's conversion of Republicans to the cause of good government in the world started with Jesse Helms. I'm convinced that Jesse Helms, bless his soul, is in heaven today because of Bono. Cardinal Egan, I hope you'll forgive me for that sacrilege, but I think Bono got him a one-way ticket to the skies.
Okay,
how in that living daylight you did it, I will never know. But
I think Jesse got me into heaven, and he blessed me after an early meeting, and I hadn't been blessed quite like that before. And it was great, but you know, one of the absurdities of a life now more and more absurd, was getting a call from a four-star general, the head of NATO, and Jim Jones, you know him, and he wanted to know more about what we were doing. He said, I have an equation that I'm taking around, which is stability equals security plus development. And he said, you know, I'm a Marine. And he said, you won't find more courage than the men and women of the Marine Corps. He said, they're incredible people. And he said, they do not mind being shot at or attacked for the right reasons, but they do not like it for the wrong reasons. I said, what, General, are the wrong reasons? And his voice quieted and he says, for being American. And it put the chills up me, and I'm not even American. We've all got a lot of stake in the idea of America, and none more than the military. And then he said an amazing thing. He said, you know, we've got billions and billions of dollars of high-tech equipment floating in the Mediterranean off the coast of Lebanon. He said, and yet we're losing against Hamas and Hezbollah because they're building schools. He said, we need to understand more the development. Then his defense, your defense minister, Gates, has saying, we have to spend more on aid. It's a strategic imperative as well as a moral imperative. And if we can get that message out, I think that will really help.
You know, every year the Pew Foundation does research around the world on people's attitudes toward the United States. And as you, the results have not been all that hopeful in the last few years, except in interesting places. Like in Central and Eastern Europe, America is still fairly popular because they think we want them to be free and we want them to be integrated in the West and have a prosperous and secure future. The other place where the United States' popularity did not wane is in 10 countries in Central and Eastern Africa, because of the president's AIDS and the malaria initiatives and because of the work of the Gates Foundation and what some of the rest of us do. Not because people agree with us, but because they think we're pulling for them. I mean, we did an announcement in Tanzania on less expensive AIDS medicine on a Sunday afternoon in a village of 2,000 that was 98% Muslim, Your Majesty, and over 10,000 people showed up. And I promise you, none of them had a television, so they didn't know who I was. I haven't been in office forever and a day. All they knew is that somebody from America was showing up to help their kids stay alive. And really, I mean, it was a, I think it's really important to remember his basic point. Let me move on to Al Gore. Last night on The Daily Show, when I was doing this, the Jon Stewart show, I made an argument that I believe about this current financial crisis. One of the things nobody's talked about is when we started over-investing in risky things in housing, it was in 2001 when the tech market, high-tech market, went down. There was still a lot of money in the economy, and the only available attractive investments in America were in housing. So too much money went into that sector in ever more risky ways. If he had been the leader of the band and we had a serious energy policy and we were going to other alternative things, a lot of this investment money could have been redirected. And I do believe that. I think that it's an economic opportunity. And I'm very worried now that after this election, after we had people generally committed to passing climate change legislation, that we'll hear the same old excuses, well, now we can't afford it. So I want you to tell us what you want all of us to do. Number one, in the current climate, what should we be doing without regard to what the laws are? And number two, do you believe that the current economic difficulties will make it harder or easier for us to pass good climate change legislation in the United States? And what could all the rest of us do to help you?
Well, Mr. President, first of all, thank you again for inviting me to come back and to join with this tremendous panel. And I want to particularly thank my friend Bono. We've had a chance to make presentations together a few times, and I really am a great fan. But I'd like to take the liberty, if I could, President Clinton, to say what I don't hear. Maybe nobody steps forward to say it because of the circumstances. But here we are at the beginning of another one of these remarkable Clinton Global initiatives. And you look at this crowd and you look at all of the resources that are being mobilized, and I just know that all of these folks and many millions more would like to say in an appropriate way, thank you for doing this. It's a fantastic effort. Now, you asked about You start with the economic crisis and what's that going to mean for the effort to solve the climate crisis. It's an interesting way to approach it. The current economic crisis was triggered, of course, by the sudden collapse of an assumption. The so-called subprime mortgages were without, many of them without collateral. People couldn't be expected to pay them back. And the assumption was somehow if you lump them together and securitize them, magically that is going to remove the risk. We all know the saying that there's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. Well, another powerful thing on that list is an assumption whose time has passed. That assumption just went splat, and things began to unravel. Now, in the midst of this frenetic effort to find a bailout, many are saying, we should have prevented this. We should have realized that the short-term greed was overcoming a clear vision of what the risk was. Well, now is the time to prevent a much worse catastrophe, because the world has several trillion dollars in subprime carbon assets based on the assumption that it is perfectly all right to put 70 million tons of global warming pollution into the atmosphere every 24 hours. Since we met here last year, the world has lost ground to the climate crisis. This is a rout. We are losing badly. The water supply is partly held in the ice packs of the mountains and the glaciers. They're disappearing. Haiti was ravaged, Mr. President, by four hurricanes. And, of course, the devastation came because the environment had been devastated with all the trees cut down. There are still people in Galveston waiting for water and food and medicine. Half a million people evacuated from their homes in California because of record fires. University of Tel Aviv just published research showing that for every 1 degree increase in temperature, there will be a 10% increase in lightning strikes all over the surface of this planet. With drier vegetation in a warmer world and more dead vegetation because of the pests and beetles that are no longer held back by frost, the fires are out of control at record levels on every continent. The strength of the storms, the depth of the drought, the movement of tropical diseases into areas that never experienced them before. This is the result of a dysfunctional, insane global system pattern that we have to change. For the first time in all of human history, we, as a species, have to make a decision. If we make the right decision, then the answer to the question you asked is, the economic crisis can truly provide an opportunity to make the right kinds of changes. What should we do? We should stop burning coal and without sequestering the CO2. The coal and oil companies have spent in the United States alone $500 million in the first 8 months of this year promoting a lie that there is such a thing as clean coal. Clean coal is like healthy cigarettes. It does not exist. It could theoretically exist. The only demonstration plant was canceled. How many such plants are there? Zero. How many blueprints? Zero. We are now, what we should do is make a one-off investment to switch our energy infrastructure from one that depends on fuel that is dirty, dangerous, destroying the habitability of this planet and rising in price, to a new global energy infrastructure that is based on fuel that is free forever. The sun and the wind and geothermal. There is a myth that the technology is not available. It is available. Concentrating geothermal power is competitive today. Wind is competitive, though intermittent, today. Geothermal is competitive today. We need in this country a unified national transmission grid, a smart grid with long-distance, low-loss transmission capacity to take the energy from the places where the sun falls and the wind blows to the places where the people live. And we need it globally, in Europe, in Africa, in Northern Africa particularly. Let's start with Darfur. Darfur has more sunlight falling on it reliably than almost any other place. There's a belt across that part of Africa into the Middle East. We ought to build solar electric plants there and connect them with these, with a super grid that goes across the Straits of Gibraltar and up through the Balkans and across the Mediterranean and replaces coal and oil. If the coal companies can actually sequester CO2 safely, then okay. But don't pretend to do it. Don't give us this this illusion, because that's what they did on Wall Street. The risk isn't there. Don't worry about it. Just keep on focus on the short term profit. Well, we have a responsibility to those who come after us, and to those who are suffering today, to knit together a global commitment to solve this climate crisis and use it as a way to stimulate the economy in the right fashion, to create jobs building these solar panels and building these windmills and insulating the homes. And we need to have an alliance between between the groups that are trying to lead the effort to fight the climate crisis and the groups who are leading the effort to fight extreme poverty and disease. Because as Martin Luther King said 40 years ago, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. In today's world, increased CO2 anywhere, in Liberia, in Sierra Leone, in Southeast Asia, CO2 anywhere is a threat to the future of human civilization everywhere. Fighting poverty and making this shift is an integral part of the answer to the climate crisis. Now, one final point. Today, the U.S. Congress is dealing with energy as well as the... They are, without debate and without a single hearing, preparing to lift the moratorium on the development of oil shale, which would vastly multiply the amount of CO2 from every gallon of gasoline. This is utter insanity, and it demonstrates that the wealth and power and influence of the entrenched carbon lobby to twist policy and to put out illusory impressions about this is overwhelming free debate. So we need to stop this. And each year we have a great discussion here, and there's progress made, but it's not enough. It's not enough. We, the human species, have to solve this crisis.
Let me ask you, give him a hand. Let me ask you one very specific question. I just completed an interesting tour of my country, and I saw just exactly what you said. Given a speech in Eagle Pass, Texas, the wind's blowing 56 miles an hour. You can't find a windmill to save your life because there's no grid to take it. Same thing in eastern Montana, the same thing in eastern Oregon, all over, around the Native American reservations. So, and as you know as well as I do, basically the electrical grids were built individually, state by state, and then connected over time. I'm so old that when I started out doing this work 30 years ago, there was still a patch of Texas that was not part of the American grid. So what's the quickest way and the most cost-effective way for the United States to build a comprehensive power grid that would enable us to maximize solar and wind production in a hurry?
Well, I've called it the Electranet. We need to have a national initiative to unify Texas, the eastern grid, and the western grid. We've got three big grids now. Currently, American business is cost over $120 billion a year just because of the failures of the current grid. It's overwhelmed, the cascading failures, the outages. It needs to be replaced anyway. We need to put in the features that are called a smart grid because that can help homeowners and small business people find exactly where to make the savings from efficiency and conservation, which are the biggest solutions involved here. But you got to have the information that empowers people to do that. And there's a new technology. You can bury these lines. They're not unsightly and doesn't cost any more, really, if you do it the right way to bury them. High voltage AC and DC from the load centers, from the production centers of sun and wind and geothermal to the places where it's used. So at the same time, by the way, we could use that same initiative to lay down a much more robust broadband network so the United States is no longer way down the list of countries that are connected to high-capacity internet services. So this should be the number one infrastructure project of this decade, whoever is elected president.
And how long would it take to do? Well, just generally, you think we could do it in 2 years?
I have a session at the Kennedy School in Harvard with the leading experts in the country next month. I'd be better able to answer that question then. 2 years sounds like it's not long enough. But within 10 years, we could, and I believe we should, make a commitment to get 100% of our electricity from renewable and carbon-free sources, hold nuclear about where it is, get a big chunk from conservation and efficiency, let concentrating solar thermal compete with photovoltaics, which will soon intersect that technology, put wind in there and let that play a big role in geothermal. If we make a decision, there is absolutely no reason why we couldn't do it. And then put the burden on the coal guys. If they really can capture and sequester safely, let them do it, and then let them participate. But the single most important thing we could do is to put a price on the CO2 in our economy today. As you know, I've long argued to reduce the payroll tax on working people and make it up with a tax on CO2. Tax what we burn, not what we earn.
Yep. Let me just ask you two other quick follow-up questions. One of the things that I pleaded with the Congress to do so far without success is to stop extending these solar and wind credits for 3 years and do it for 6 to 10 years because one of our sponsors, Tom Golisano, there, he's trying to put the wind energy all over upstate New York, and we got a two-year wait. Two-year wait in most places for commercial windmills because we don't have the production capacity in this country, and the same thing is true around the world. Lots of places are just giving up jobs they could have. We could have it in the Middle East, not just solar, but wind. We could do a lot of things, and you've got to get the economics right. So the same thing is true, I think, and Neville's on the board of General Motors, I think, aren't you still? So they're looking at the Volt car, you know, the electric car, and Al and I have already had this conversation about how we think we should go quickly to to electric cars and hybrid electric vehicles. What should we do on that? How can we accelerate the move on the production side of solar and wind? I think if we laid the infrastructure, it wouldn't matter what the tax credits are. People would go, they'd know the tax credits are going to be there. You agree with that?
I do think that the unified national grid, the Electranet, would pull all these technologies in. But we need that tax credit. Over the last 20 years, it has been allowed to expire 17 times. Now, in business, if you have a business plan and a numbers plugged in to represent the tax credit, and you know that the Congress is playing games with it and it's going to expire every year or so, then you can't rely on it. And that kills the investment. So they ought to stop playing games. And by the way, the carbon lobby, the coal and some of the oil companies are up there lobbying against the renewable energy tax credit. And let me say one other thing. I believe that for a carbon company to spend money convincing the stock-buying public that the risk from the global climate crisis is not that great represents a form of stock fraud because they are misrepresenting a material fact. If you're a carbon company and you're going out there telling people that you're trying to convince to buy your stock that the climate crisis is not that big a deal, and you're surreptitiously giving money to these phony think tanks that go out and try to gin up phony arguments when the entire global scientific community has put out 5 unanimous reports over the last 20 years, practically screaming from the rooftops to solve this. If you're a carbon company doing those things, in my opinion, you're guilty of a form of stock fraud, and I hope these state attorney generals around the country will take some action on that. And if you're a young person looking at the future of this planet and looking at what is being done right now and not done, I believe we've reached the stage where it is time for civil disobedience to prevent the construction of new coal plants that do not have carbon capture and sequestration.
Thank you. What about Neville Jort? You are out. What can we do to accelerate the movement to electric cars? What's the most important thing we can do on the tax side or other things? This is a huge deal. We have the technology now that's affordable. We're not producing it. Israel's going to have 100,000 electric cars and by the next year, a year after next, I guess. Go ahead.
Well, the photovoltaic cells are still very expensive. We're not quite down the curve, but now we're getting critical mass where I think we can look at that in a few years' time. And certainly General Motors has put a very firm stake in the ground. But it's still only 45 miles before you have to then recharge or go to backup. The real issue is, again, we're back into distribution systems. We're back into the ability to recharge in parking garages, at offices. At shopping malls.
But you can produce enough batteries to meet the demand if there's a
system. No, you can't do that. But it'll gear up. I mean, I know the time frame is not working the right way. But I get asked about, where are the fortunes of the 21st century going to be made? They're going to be made in all of these areas which affect our planet. The people who are making the investments in wind energy, in photovoltaic cells, the people who are, you talk to Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute, some of the things he's doing. Those ideas are now taking root, and I think that it is now over the tipping point in terms of where investors are looking to develop these new technologies. Unfortunately, there's still a long lead time to get to where we are, and that's the danger point that I know you're pointing out. But I'm optimistic that the technologies are there now, and providing we can make the public investments in terms of putting in that infrastructure, then I think we can move forward rapidly. All of the experiments at the moment are in small countries. That's fine, because that will show that it is viable and it can be done.
Your Majesty, if we could get some of the oil countries in the Middle East to fund it, do you think we could convince the non-oil producing countries in the Middle East to try to become models of clean energy, to embrace in a much more aggressive way than they have solar and wind and alternatives?
Well, let me just say that, first of all, we're halfway through towards the Millennium Development Goals, and we're seriously off track. And as a result of the increase in fuel prices, food prices, financial instability. The UN predicts that 100 million more people will be pushed in absolute poverty. And so that creates a situation where we will be losing some of our hard-won development gains that we've managed to achieve. So that calls on the entire world community to pull together and rethink this whole situation. Now, the increase in fuel prices hasn't obviously been bad news for everyone. Many of the oil-producing countries now have excess liquidity. But what we need to look at is, I think many people will be surprised to realize that not all Arab countries are oil-producing. In fact, if we take just a quick snapshot, 60% of the Arab world is under the age of 30. That's 70 million young people. 1 in 4 of them are unemployed. And 6 million children are out of school. 3.5 million are girls. 1 in 5 live in absolute poverty or below the poverty line. So with this increase in oil prices, the disparity between those Arab countries that have oil and those that don't is going to be pronounced, which will lead to possible political instability. you'll have fractures appearing in the social landscape of our country. So with this huge transfer of wealth comes a global a region and a global responsibility. A lot of these countries now need to be thinking not just investing in physical infrastructure, but investing in the human capital in the Arab world, investing in programs, social programs. So not just expanding education, but reforming education, in job creation, in poverty alleviation, in sustainable development. That's the kind of thinking that we need to be looking at. And, you know, it's beginning to happen. For example, in Abu Dhabi, Mubadala is investing its gas and oil reserves in exploring renewable energy. They're creating a city that's going to have zero emissions. They're partnering with MIT University to establish a university there that's going to be just dedicated to renewable sources of energy. So they're beginning to go in that direction. But I think more needs to be done, both in our region and around the world. I was very happy to hear that, you know, Saudi Arabia a couple of months ago donated $500 million to the World Food Program. They need to be more involved in our region. They need to be more involved in Africa. There's a lot of vested interest there. And the thing is, this is an opportunity to do the right thing. You know, there's not many times in history where you get that window of opportunity. In Africa, for example, this is an opportunity for us to do what's right, which is to not just think of helping by giving aid, but to really do the right thing of investment and trade, for example, in agriculture, which will then help us solve the increase in the food prices.
We're a half hour over time. I'm going to give Bono the last word, and I have one final thing to say. But just remember this. There are 53 developing countries, 53, that import more than 70% of their energy. Almost 100% of them, theoretically, could be made completely self-sufficient with clean energy. It would put more people to work if we recycle the profits, as the Queen suggested. So go ahead.
Just picking up on what Her Majesty Ness was saying and says so incredibly eloquently. The three extremes come together on your continent. Extreme climate crisis, extreme poverty, and extreme ideology. And you see it in a place like Darfur, which we don't like to characterize as being a problem of extreme poverty, but there's nothing there. There's dirt, dry dirt. There's tribal difficulties because of water management and livestock. You see, in the Horn of Africa is now a stated priority of Al-Qaeda. And what we need from the next president of the United States, whoever that is someone to weave together these three strands into a cohesive way for the United States to meet the future, dealing with extreme ideology, dealing with the climate crisis, dealing with that. I actually don't think it'll happen without putting the three together. I think it's a whole rethink, a whole reimagining of the American enterprise is necessary. And it will happen, I'm pretty sure, because after cataclysmic times, you have these, it takes sometimes catastrophe for people to sit down and redraw the map. And I think that these issues that you've heard today afford the United States a chance to redescribe itself to the rest of the world. I think the innovation is here naturally, and the rest of the world will follow.
Let's give them all a hand. They were great, weren't they? Now, I'll have more to say about this, and others will about some of the more immediate things. But one of the really compelling points that Al Gore made in his presentation, he talked about the four storms that had buffeted Haiti, and we'll talk more about that later. But we have a lot of immediate issues here. And I have become sort of a permanent junior partner and straight man over the last 5 years to my predecessor as president. And he's our last surprise guest today, so I'd like to ask former President George Bush to come out here and make an announcement.
again. As Barbara Bush might say, the political odd couple is at it again. I apologize for dropping in unannounced. And when I called my friend, President Clinton, Bill, last week, and asked if he wanted to team up once again to help the Gulf Coast communities so terribly devastated by another havoc-filled hurricane, not only did he say yes, he also invited me to come here to this prestigious gathering. And I join him in announcing our new initiative to this most distinguished audience. If you're keeping score at home, this is the third time that he and I have teamed up to help the victims of natural disasters. We did it in early 2005, following the Indian Ocean tsunami that cast its waves of destruction from the coast of Western Africa all the way to the islands of Indonesia and claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. And then we teamed up in the fall of 2005 after Hurricane Katrina and Rita too slammed into the New Orleans, into the Gulf Coast, leaving the city of New Orleans devastated. And we tried to help in small towns like Cameron, Louisiana, and others as well. And since then, I might add, both President Clinton and I have accepted appointments as UN special envoys to help with disaster relief overseas, including earthquake relief in Pakistan. And so we've not confined these efforts just to America, but now we're coming to you just as we will be appealing to every American and every friend of America around the world to help our coastal communities recover from this latest onslaught of Mother Nature. From the historic island of Galveston, filled with its registered landmarks, to High Island, Port Arthur, Beaumont, and into Louisiana, on the way to Cameron, Terrebonne, Calcasieu, and St. Mary parishes, I'm sad to report that life is anything but normal for people down there today. There are families without homes, children without schools, dozens of American communities struggling for survival. And just as we could not turn away from the tsunami and Katrina victims 3 years ago, we cannot turn away from the good people today. So our appeal to you is a very simple one. Go to www.bushclintoncoastalfund.org, if you can remember that, and give as much as you can. That's bushclintoncoastalfund.org. And the money we collect will go to help with whole communities along the Gulf Coast recover, offering them the chance to reclaim some sense of normalcy along with the basic infrastructure any society needs to function. The road ahead will be a long and costly one for these towns and cities, but with our help they can begin the healing process and take critical steps toward rebuilding their future. The good news for President Clinton, for Bill and me, is that Jim Baker has agreed to be chairman of the fund, day-to-day running the operations of it. And a lot of you in this room know him well, and you know the best thing that Bill Clinton and I can do is probably just get out of his way. He's already off and running, and he's watching this right now back in Houston with a group of leaders from the Gulf Coast region who also are ready to go to work. So thank you all for hearing me out. My congratulations to my friend Bill on yet another highly successful global initiative. And you know, there's a coveted invite. I wasn't sure they were going to let me in. But when I told them I knew Bono, well, everything seemed to work out fine. So here I am, and very grateful to President Clinton for what he does, not only with helping on this, but with this whole global initiative. I have great respect for him, and we're friends. And that's a good thing to be when you're my age, a real friend.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to say, you know, this is very important to me. I love working with President Bush, and this whole Houston area is a big deal. You should know this. Houston used to be known as the oil capital of America. They've just adopted the cleanest, most energy-efficient building standards for new buildings of any city in the United States, second only to Vancouver and all of North America. They're trying to modernize, and their whole effort to do this is at risk of being compromised. And, of course, Galveston and the other areas are in trouble. So I'm looking forward to this. I went to Jim Baker's Institute to make a speech, so he will forgive me if I gig him a little bit. I want Al Gore to know that he has promised to count every single dollar that is given to this fund, and we are going to get it out there and help those people. So I hope you'll help us. Thank you all. Let's get on with the schedule and try to get back on time.
Thank you.
Very nice. Thank you. Thank you. The famous group you got up here. Good.